Hey friends, look, I'm about to do something which makes me feel a bit queasy deep down, but my husband slash producer assures me that this is what every podcaster does. So here we go. Grab onto your handbags and let's get this shit done. It has been wonderful seeing our audience grow over the last few months, and I would really love the chance to find out a bit more about you. Who's listening? What would you like to hear more of? And who would you love us to have on the show? So you can find me on social media. I'm Scorthorn Gab on Twitter and at GJoska on Instagram. So just shoot me a message and tell me what you're into. And while you're at it, tell all your friends. That's right. If you've just listened to this podcast, get on your social media and say, hey, I just listened to this great podcast. No, it actually really does help the show out. So if you could give that a little tinkle, that'd be great. Or you can subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. Getting a bit excited thinking about hearing from you. Hello, I'm Gabrielle Scorthorn, and this is Back From Reality. When I was 17 years old, my dad smuggled me out of a school excursion so that I could line up for hours at my local Westfield to audition for the reality television show Fresh Meat, where I would be competing to be a presenter on Channel V, which sounds pretty legit. But when you're plucked from suburban obscurity and thrust into the public eye in a world of sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and you're not even legal, shit goes down. What happened over the next few months shaped the rest of my life in ways that I'm still discovering today. In this series of podcasts, I will be speaking with a different guest each week from the world of reality television. These chats will cover the highs and lows of the reality TV experience, how their lives have changed as a result, and what it's like to come back from reality. My guest today is Michelle Caron, who appeared in season 7 of Married at First Sight, which aired earlier this year on Channel 9. You might recall a couple of weeks ago we released an interview with Bella Frizzer from season 3 of Married at First Sight. Now, while Bella wasn't overly critical about the maths team, in more recent years, a number of contestants have spoken out, painting an increasingly distressing picture of their treatment during their time on the show. From the outside, it seems as though there has been an evolution in the production of the show and the toll that it takes on its participants. Michelle Caron's account of her experience on the show can at times be quite a distressing one. So listeners should be advised that this interview contains references to domestic violence, self-harm and suicide, which might be triggering for some people. You should also be aware that the interview features descriptions of incidences that contain explicit and abusive language, and it is not suitable for children. So, Michelle, you were on Married at First Sight.
Yes.
How did you end up getting cast in the show? Did you apply or were you scouted?
Well, I applied, I first applied 3 years ago, and I got through most of the process, and I pulled out at the last minute because I started to date someone from high school. And then this year, last year actually, because it got released last year, they kind of just said to me, do you want to apply? Because we think we've got someone perfect for you. And just like, okay, I'm single, I might as well. Yeah, okay. So I still had to go to a couple of the auditions and still fill out the forms again. But basically, my application was there. The old one was still useful. So yeah.
You said that you still had to do some of the audition process. What is that process like?
Well, it's just going in, talking to the executive producers, one of the executive producers from Channel 9, and they just ask you a whole heap of questions, which then get used as part of the show as well. So you don't, little do you know that they get used later on. So I think it's really daunting probably if it's the first time you've done it. But if you don't really care if you're going to be on it or not, then, yeah, you just be yourself and you've got nothing to lose. Or you've got everything, really. You just don't realise you've got so much to lose.
Because on Married at First Sight, there is a team of experts and they use their scientific...
That's very loose, that word.
a loose term of some scientific experts, and they are using their scientific expertise to match you perfectly and precisely with someone. What kind of information did you disclose to that team for the matching purposes?
So, well, we did a lot of questionnaires. So, you know, like the Mayer-Briggs kind of questionnaires. You do a lot of personality tests and questionnaires like that. I don't think that any scientist actually analyses them. Or they might do, but they're not looking for your perfect match. they're looking for your perfect trigger. So they're looking for the person that would actually trigger you, or the person that's the most similar to you that you probably wouldn't get along with. So they're looking for someone with your personality traits or someone that would irritate your personality traits. It's not those three experts that are there. They haven't done any of that. They're just actors. I think they have got the degrees. They're not registered. They couldn't be because, yeah.
I mean, it's kind of genius, isn't it? Because here's this person wanting to find love, and so they are giving in to the process. They're giving a lot of information because they think that this is going to help them find the one.
Yeah, and you do. And the thing is, you get so wrapped up with the process, you become so vulnerable, and then you disclose some of your most intimate fears, the most intimate information that you've probably not disclosed to anyone. And the thing is, the mastery of these producers is that they use that to make a show. And lo and behold, all of a sudden, the thing that scares you the most from when you were 7 years old appears on your wedding day, or appears at your honeymoon, or randomly at the most intimate dinner party. It just appears. And how did they know? Well, you disclosed it, but you don't remember you did, because it was in one of those questionnaires. And it's really funny. And I started going through all my questionnaires just recently because I had to find out, why did all these things happen? There's so many little coincidences. You think, I did not say any of this, but you do. And you don't even know you said it. And it's scary because you're so excited. You are excited. Even if it was one of the girls or guys that thought they were going to be famous, part of you thinks, I just might find my one.
The actual questioning and the interviews, are they quite lengthy as well? So you let things slip and then you forget about, is that?
Yeah, you do. You let a lot slip. And they ask you the same question in a variety of ways. It's very similar to the kind of testing we do with the police when we do, like when we do the psychometric testing where you're really analysing the way that people mentally think. So you ask the same question 13 different ways to see in that situation, how would that person react? So if you presented them with this particular present, what would they do? What would happen every single time that they were presented with the same thing? But they just ask the question different ways. And it's so clever. It's really, really clever. And we don't even realise that we had answered the same question. And I should have known. I should have known, but I didn't. Because I was daydreaming about my happy ever after and my true love kiss, and I'm filling out the forms like really la-di-da and really so in love, because they've already told me, they've sold me already. Like when they rang me and said, we think we've got that person, yeah. apply now. So all you have to do is fill out the forms, apply. Like, I thought I'd won already.
And do you think, because you had done the process before, do you think that the second time when they dangled that carrot of we've got the perfect person for you, that you maybe even disclosed more?
Yeah, and so after the girls' hens night, I thought for a second, because I met the girls and some of them seemed a little bit dramatic and had a few problems, and I just said, look, if this is going to be dramatic or drama, I don't want to be part of it. I really don't. And I said that to the executive producer and she said, you're going to love this guy. You're absolutely going to love him. Okay. And I said, I really do not want to go through with this if it's going to be. She said, no, we've picked the most gorgeous person for you. Just like, okay, I trust you. Wow. What a person to trust.
So you don't meet Steve at all, well, your partner, the one, you don't meet them at all before you see them on the day?
No. So, but one thing that they did do with me and they really stuffed up is because I had put my frequent flyers on, I knew his name and I wasn't allowed to tell anyone that they had stuffed up. I knew his name and I tried Google searching him everywhere, and he had already come off social media. I couldn't find any Steve Burleys anywhere. I'd found the other people, the film guy, the producer, the cameraman, and the audio, but I couldn't find the Steve Burley. Lucky, I wouldn't have gone.
Married at first sight, that's such a big premise. Did you have any reservations about the premise or the process going in?
No. No. What an idiot. No. Because, you know, I come from a European background. Arranged marriage is something that happens and it works. And thought, well, nothing's worked so far. Like, I've been single for so long. Give this a go. Like, arranged marriage, somebody, an expert is doing it. Why not? It could work. Yes. It didn't feel wrong at all. I couldn't even fathom that it would go wrong.
Did you have reservations about what taking part in a reality television show would have the impacts of that on your life?
I must not have even thought about the reality TV part at all. And that sounds really dumb. And I know it does. I just thought of all I wanted to do is meet my one. I didn't even think about the TV show at all. I remember Jules and Cam and they were happy. And all I wanted was, I just wanted to meet my one. That's it. That's all I wanted. I didn't care what was going to happen apart from that. The show meant nothing. I just was going to meet my one. I didn't even think about the reality TV show. I barely watched TV, so I didn't really, I don't know, we block watched all the other shows, the previous seasons, and I kind of even really didn't even think of the people as people. I just thought, oh yeah, they're like actors almost, and apart from Jules and Cam, like I didn't actually even seem to think about the reality TV part, which is, sounds really naive.
Well, no, I mean, because why would you? You're not an actor. You've never done it before. But, you know, speaking to some producers that I have from reality television, they say the most important thing is that you brief your guests on what they're about to get into and you brief them on the reality television side of it. Did you feel like the producers briefed you properly about what you were about to get into?
No. Did you feel briefed?
No. No, not really. But I think, do you know what it is? It's because, you know, I was on reality television such a long time ago now, but I think I was so excited about the premise, you know, I could get a job on this show. So maybe if they did brief me, I wasn't listening.
I didn't ever want to be on television, but I didn't care about the TV. I had 150 followers on Instagram. I didn't really care if I got another 150 or whatever. I didn't need any of that. And when I got the blue tick, I didn't even know what the blue tick meant. So it didn't mean anything to me. Like, and even Steve would talk about like, oh, people are going to love you. You're going to have a huge following. And I'm just like, I don't know what to do with the following anyway. So what do I do with it? It's kind of almost wasted on me. Like, you know, with the young girls that all wanted the following so that they could promote themselves or, I don't know, so that they could be seen in the media. Whereas, like, why do people follow me? Just because, like, I show them my garden and I show them what I'm doing that day? I don't know. Why do they follow me?
Like, was there a psych evaluation before you went in?
There was plenty, but I don't think anyone asked us, do you know what reality TV means? I didn't know. I didn't know that I couldn't go to the shops without somebody saying something to me. I didn't know that I'd never have my own Instagram account back and I couldn't just post about my niece or nephew on it. I didn't know that I wouldn't have any kind of privacy like that. I didn't know that I couldn't go to my letterbox without somebody taking photos of me and stuff like that. I didn't know that was going to happen.
So you go into this process not really understanding what's about to happen. And then very early on in the process, you are married to a complete stranger. When you first saw Steve on that day, he's at the altar, what were your first thoughts?
Yeah, obviously the guy marrying me, I thought he was going to be the guy. I didn't think that. I've never dated someone, well, I had dated someone as old as Steve, but I was like way younger when I did. But I think, see, and that's one of the things, like he was wearing a grey suit with a maroon tie. That was something that we talked about when I told my family that I was getting married. That's something that my granddad used to wear, a grey suit with a maroon tie. And my granddad wasn't a nice person. And it was like a joke, as long as he's not wearing a grey suit with a maroon tie. It's like they freaking did it on purpose. They put him in a grey suit with a maroon tie. And it was like a trigger for my whole family. And he looked like my granddad. It was shit.
Had you disclosed this information to the producers?
We were talking about it when I announced to my family and my sisters. Like, we were joking on camera and they don't show everything. And he's saying, what sort of guy do you want? And we're saying, oh, you know, someone who's like muscly, someone who's like young, someone who's this, who's that. Everything that you want, they give you the opposite. And they said, as long as he's not wearing this, because, you know, one of the brother-in-laws ended up wearing that one day and we just made, it's just a bad memory from my granddad, but they thought it would be actually funny to do it. But my auntie was distressed by it. One of my cousins was distressed on the wedding. Yeah, it was distressing. And he looked very similar to my granddad. So when we did it the first time and then they make you go back into the car to do it again, I ripped my hair out. I ripped my makeup off. I like wiped it off. I wasn't going back. When you hear me on the commercial say, oh, there was a truck, he's probably a serial killer, I'm going with him. I actually was. I really wanted to run away. I didn't want to go back and do it again. I wanted to leave. My son bawled. He's so distressed because that wedding was just, my son was holding on to me and wouldn't let me go. He said, I don't want you to go. I don't want you to go. And they didn't show that at all because that would have been heart-wrenching for all of Australia. But instead they show my daughter being a bitch and then that's okay. But they don't show my son like crying for his mum because they've just married me to this freaking, I don't know, actor or wannabe actor. And then my son never speaks again on the whole series.
And then you have to go on a honeymoon and then you move in. I mean, what was that adjustment like of sharing your personal space with this person on a daily basis?
On that first night, I said, I'm not sharing a room because I wouldn't. And then on the honeymoon, I said, I'm not sharing a room. And going forward, I will never share a room. It's a two-bedroom or I will leave immediately. I don't feel comfortable with this person and I won't. So, yeah, we had a two-bedroom the whole time. And I think a lot of the other participants weren't happy with that, but I wasn't prepared to stay. I did try to leave a few times, but I suppose I think everyone had a value to the show. We all had value and we all had probably like a script that they were working to. We didn't know what our character was or our script, and they probably just needed us to stay till the end. They needed some drama. And Steve was probably on their books anyway from the beginning. We never got to have the opportunity to really leave, even though we had planned to leave. Something would always come up. We never left.
Did you ever get to, because what it appears like on the show is that you and Steve got to a really good friendship place. Did you start to relax into it and actually develop quite a solid friendship throughout?
Yeah. So what happens is at first, like you know you don't like the person. And the thing is you fight it. And then you realise, I'm not getting out. I'm stuck. And it's like Stockholm. Up until about 3 or 4 weeks, I was just fighting it. I was fighting and fighting and I was trying to get out. And I got really low. Like I actually tried to jump off our balcony, but we had two fences. And so I couldn't make the second fence. It was the same weekend that there was two other people that tried to kill themselves too. And then I just realised if I fight him, and everyone hates me because everyone loves Steve because they all think he's fucking fantastic. So no one talks to me if I fight Steve. So then if you go along with it and you just like him, then it makes it so much easier. And so then you end up falling for your captor and you fall in love with your captor. It's exactly like Stockholm. Because you have to. It's the way you survive. And you believe, you truly, truly believe that you love this person because they are your lifeline. They help you survive. Without them, you're nothing in the group. You need them because if somebody's going to pick on you, you need someone like to have your back and you need your partner. So you do. You fall in love. You have a friendship and you do laugh sometimes, but you go crazy otherwise. What do? It's just like being in jail. You're in jail, but you don't like sit there and be miserable the whole time. You have some good days.
You mentioned just before that you tried to jump off of the balcony and that other contestants had also tried to harm themselves in the shooting. A lot of former Married at First Sight contestants have said that show in particular, the shooting process is so traumatic and very damaging to its contestants. What is it about the shooting process that is so damaging?
So, like, like one particular thing, like one, and I just was discussing this just the other day, and it's like so toxic. It's like we're having an argument about his son, so his son that lives in the UK, and we start getting very, very, like, we're arguing very aggressively, like with words, and he's like standing and he's like screaming and like there's arms thrashing and stuff like that, and he's like swearing about my family, and like he calls me out for swearing like all the time, but he's using a lot of profanity, and he's swearing about my family calling and me having people that love me and stuff like that, and he's got these, and then he starts banging doors in his room and all of this. They're filming this all. They've got it all on camera. Anyway, they're egging me on to go into a room where there's this angry man like throwing things around and bashing the doors, and I'm sitting out there. I'm scared. I'm a DV survivor. I'm not going into a room with an angry man who's like throwing shit around and throwing abuse at me. Like, I am not going there. And they're just like, Australia's going to fucking hate you. You're a heartless bitch. How dare you don't go in there? And I'm just like, I don't fucking care. I said, I have had my nose broken before. I'm not going in there to get my nose broken again. And they're trying to make me go into a room where he's swearing. And I'm sitting here thinking, Australia's going to hate me because I'm not going into a room where he's probably going to smash me in the face. And these people are screaming at me saying, go in. He's screaming at me like saying, you're a fucking cunt. And like, then what do? Like, you're torn both ways. He ends up going out and you're just like, thank fuck this is all over. But it's not, because they want to reconvene in 15 minutes. Everything has to come back, and like, you don't want to go back to that in 15 minutes. You don't want to go back to that ever fucking again. And in the meantime, he gets to go. He goes and has a beer with the boys. In the meantime, you get the executive producer come in speaking to you and telling you, you're a dumb fucking bitch. You just go in there and act like a woman would. Any other woman would have gone in there and given him a hug. Instead, you just sat there on there doing nothing. And I'm just like, what do you do then? What do you do? She's a fucking lady telling me, a mother, telling me that I'm a heartless bitch for not going in to get my nose smashed. No, that's why you get fucked up. And that's just 1 hour of filming. And they have that on film. After that, I go out, because he's gone to get a drink. I go out, I go downstairs to get a drink. And it just so happens that's the same night I get my drink spiked. And then I was missing for nearly 3 hours. Do you think anyone fucking went looking for me? No. I lost 2 hours of my life that I have no idea where I was. And do you think maths cared? No. And that was the same night. So that's why it all just makes me really, really upset, because they've got a duty of care. They had a duty of care to me that night to not force me to go into the room. And yes, I was already upset. And going to the club wherever I went to have a drink, I was obviously upset in the first place going there. So I was vulnerable anyway. But then to have your drink spiked, only fuck knows what happened to me. And I don't even want to know. There's CCTV that I can ask for, but I don't want to know. I already know too much from maths. Why would I want to know what happened in those 2 fucking hours?
And this incident was brought to production's attention. You were made to see a Married at First Sight approved doctor. You couldn't see a doctor of your own choice. The doctor was quite sceptical and diminishing of the incident. And then when your partner, Steve, wanted to get CCTV footage, he was told that he couldn't from production. So it seems like the producers were really trying to minimise a very significant incident that had happened to yourself. Why were they trying to minimise this event?
Because they should have called an ambulance. When they found me, I was just on a curb, on a step. Like, I couldn't move my arms and legs. I was vomiting. I'd weed and pooed myself. I had done everything. I couldn't control any bodily functions. Like, it is not a normal reaction. I was, like, I had some sort of drugs, and I've got the test results now, finally, after months and months of asking for them. On the CCT, the only thing that I'd like to get is the fact that they didn't even try to help pick me up. The producers didn't even, they just let me slide down the stairs to get to the hotel. Just let me, like, flop like a doll.
Was hospital ever mentioned? No one wanted to take you to hospital? Or?
They were just yelling at me saying, you got too drunk. You just got too drunk. And they didn't call Steve because they said, we didn't want to humiliate you. It's like, anyway, we were fighting. But the thing was, still, I'm sure even Steve would know that anyone who would have seen me would know. You couldn't get that paralytic even in 2 hours of drinking. Anyway, I kept my pants that I had on. I had never dry cleaned them, which sounds like a Monica Lewinsky thing. It's like, I know it sounds really gross, but I just thought, oh, one day I might.
I mean, it sounds like with the producers using that kind of language towards you and it sounds like they were quite aggressive. Were there ever moments where they were really lovely? Because they must have gained your trust at some point in time. You know, were there different producers who were, some were nice, some were mean? You know, what was your relationship like?
The executive producers, that's them talking to you like that's a particular lady, Tara. She would talk to you like that. No, the producers that you have with you, they're all different. So, like, the producer that I had, he was absolutely lovely. So everyone has their, each couple has their own producer. Some are really, really good. Some are bad. And, yeah, we were really lucky. We had a really nice one. You become really close friends or, you know, you think they're your friends and, yeah, you disclose so much to them. And, yeah, they're, some are really, really thoughtful and kind, and some are just like, once we had someone different and Steve looked like he was having a heart attack and she just wanted to film it, but when our normal producer came, he just like went off his nut at her, and it was just like, you know, you don't film someone having a heart attack, you actually just call the ambulance or send them to the doctors. Okay, yay. So I don't know. They all have different moral compasses, just like people, I suppose.
But, I mean, as a show, you should have a collective moral compass. Anyone working within this one unit, they should all be operating in a similar way.
There's no moral compass on the show.
Right.
It'd come from the top, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, you would hope. And the top was the worst.
If you're going from the executive producer, she has no morals, so, and she's disgusting human. So she will do anything to make it dramatic, anything. Like just before the dinner party, if there wasn't enough drama, she will just tell you something, go into your tent and just tell you something just to stir it up. Just to make sure that she just twists something to make sure that it just is that little bit juicier.
You said before, and I think you said in an interview as well, that you did want to leave several times and they pressured you to stay in the experiment, in the show. What forms of pressure did they apply to you? How did they convince you to stay?
So the one time that I had to, like, change my response, that was basically 8 hours of just stay, and, like, then different people coming in, making sure that I write stay. It was holding up filming, everyone saying, Michelle, for fuck's sake, just write stay. Fucking hell, just write stay. And then you're just like, okay, I can just write stay and then this will all be over. So then you're very, it's almost like everyone then is pressuring you, because all you have to write is stay, then it's over for everyone. They don't have to sit there anymore. Filming's not delayed. Otherwise, everything's delayed because of you. Everyone hasn't eaten because of you. Everyone, and no one's done anything because of you. You will get talked to, and then they'll go back to your partner. Are you writing stay? You don't feel pressure just for yourself. You feel pressure for everyone. You know, like where we sit for the commitment ceremony, They put everyone there waiting. They're not allowed to talk. They just have to sit there waiting. No food, no water, just waiting for you. It's like cruel. Like, it's so cruel. You know what's happening and they're really good at it.
At any point in time, if you want to just take a minute or just let us know.
Yeah, like, no. I don't know if that sounds convincing, because it sounds very wishy-washy to me, but it's like it doesn't seem like a lot, but it actually his at the time, because people are just like, for fuck's sake, just write stay. You're going to be here for another week. Who fucking cares? Just write stay. That's what the thought process is. It's like, if you stay or leave, just it's another fucking week. Who cares? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, it doesn't sound wishy-washy to me.
And you just think, oh, I fucking hate myself. I want to kill myself here. I don't want to do this. But then you just do it, because then everyone gets to go home. And it's like the dinner parties. You know, if you don't have that fight, if you don't say something, then, you know, we're not going home until 2 or 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. But if you say it, if you have that fight at 11 o'clock, we can go home at 11:15 at night. Like, you know, so you can have the fight at 11, or you can resist and resist, and like they'll just keep pressuring you until 2 or 3 in the morning, and you'll end up doing it at 2 or 3, but you'll just be more fucking pissed off by then, because you're tired, you're hungry or thirsty, and then you're just going to go like off your chops even worse. So you just do it at 11, everyone gets to go home early, and you just get it over and done with. And it's kind of like, I know I'm going to look like an idiot. It doesn't make sense, but I'm doing it and I'm taking it for the team.
You also, you had an accident on the show that you later had to get surgery for after the show. I know that you've said previously that the show has not reimbursed you for an accident that occurred on the show. Is that still the case?
They didn't reimburse me for it, but they gave me a lump sum of money because they were concerned that my inability to work was affecting my mental health. They didn't acknowledge that it was for the accident, because if they acknowledged it was for the accident, that would mean that they were negligent because they didn't provide medical attention at the honeymoon.
And there could be long-term effects that they would then be liable for if they admitted to it.
Yes.
Because something that people don't really realise with reality television is, I think that, you know, when Australia watches someone on television, they go, they're getting a lot of money to be on television. And with reality television, that is not the case. There are huge financial implications moving forward with someone's ability to work afterwards. I mean, were you fairly paid while you were shooting, firstly?
Well, I think we were getting paid something like $150 a day or something. We were living in the centre of Sydney. We brought our clothes. The girls would get their spray tans, get your lashes, your hair done, your nails, your makeup, and your dresses and your shoes.
That's all on you.
Yes, and you do that twice a week. And then plus, if you're going to do extra things like for the other days that you film, you can't wear the same outfit twice. And that's a lot of money. Even if you're hiring the outfits, it's still a lot of money. I was talking to Casey. Casey said she was in quite a bit of debt, and she was only on there for like 4 weeks or 6 weeks or something. But like, I'm still paying off my debts from MAFS. I'll be paying them off for ages, because you don't work, you don't get paid from your work. What you're getting paid on the show doesn't cover what you're spending. And then people think, oh, yeah, you make it up with your social media. Well, I don't know. Somebody tell me how to make it up with your social media, because I don't know. Maybe some people are, but I don't know. That's not what I was planning to do, so I don't do that. So every contract I've signed on social media hasn't really been money, so just like, I'm not good with that.
You mentioned before that the show has affected your ability to work.
Definitely, and your credibility as a worker. People just think you're a joke. Like, if you've actually got education and you've got a credible position in society, people won't take you seriously. You're like a novelty then. And like, everything changes. Like, it's difficult to work because, one, you forget how to work because people have been doing stuff for you all the time. People think for you all the time. They tell you what to say. They tell you what to do. So you're conditioned to do that. Also, then no one takes you seriously because you're just this person that was on a reality TV show and you're actually just a joke.
And what were you doing before? Were you a teacher?
Yeah, so like I am a teacher, but I train police recruits now. So I've been training police recruits, and I work with the culturally and linguistic diverse program with police recruits. But I get to do some learning support with all the other recruits as well. So that's really good.
I'm really glad that you've been able to find something afterwards.
Well, yeah, it's what I was doing, but it's taken almost a year to get back into being able to work. But I still, I don't feel entirely comfortable.
Right. And then when the show comes out, how did you find watching yourself back?
Well, yeah, that's a surprise. So you were filming it is something and then watching it back. Yes, we watched it because we had to comment on our Instagram. So we thought it was going to be exciting. We filmed this. We thought it was going to be similar to what we filmed. That was just like, wow, I didn't know that I did that. It was something totally different to what we had just filmed. And I think that was probably one, shocking, two, surprising. And it took a good month or month and a half to realize that nothing was actually going to come out exactly how it happened. I was just gobsmacked nearly every episode that I was on. Just like, I can't believe that that's what they got out of that. It was traumatic watching. It was so traumatic.
So even though you'd filmed it and you were there, you didn't know what was going to happen next because they could have turned it anyway.
Yeah, like the words. Like even when I listen to what I've said, you hear me talking and it's like I talk with the stutter. It's like they've cut out every second word that I've said. And I got one of my friends who does sound to do some segments of my voice. And he said that he picked a couple sections. He said these words weren't even filmed in the same area. Like some were filmed in different spaces. Some were filmed inside. Some were filmed in a studio. Some were filmed in a house. He said that you could pick the words weren't even filmed in the same kind of area, but they made the sentences together because I can't imagine that I had said some of the stuff. And the words that I said, it was the complete opposite to what I had said anyway. And I just thought, well, it's fiction.
How did you find the public's reaction to you personally?
Surprising. I was surprised, firstly, that Endemol or Maths showed Steve so compassionately. They actually showed him a lot kinder than he was, and I was very disappointed about that. I was surprised at how much hate I got, but then I got a lot of support as well, so that was kind. But I didn't actually realise that how many women around the late 30s and 40s would hate me, like actually hate me. So much. So, yeah.
Because you mentioned that people really loved Steve in the production.
Well, the production didn't. Like the people, the participants did.
Oh, the contestants.
The contestants loved him. He was like that ultimate salesman. Oh, no, like the audio guys, the soundies and the cameraman. Like I'd see them. I'd look at them and think, can you see what's happening? Can you hear this guy? Like, you know, this can't be happening. This is staged. Like, these reactions can't be happening. This guy has been paid by the producer, the executive producer, to do this.
I guess what I'm kind of hinting at is if he was very compliant with the producers and kind of, you know, was very easy to work with, very open to their suggestion that maybe they gave him a kinder edit because he was so good to the show.
He was already signed up with the media before he got married. That was his only aim. So, yeah, he was going to bend over and take it. However, he wasn't really going to fight it. He was all in for America. He's been doing all their promo stuff. He wanted to do it.
How have you been after the show? You mentioned that it's quite traumatic.
And really, really low. And yeah, and I think you go through really bad periods and then you go up, but it's really hard. The thing is, you try to not regret things. You try not to regret anything you do, and it is experience, but it's a fucking shit experience. It's a really fucking shit experience, and I hope that no one else has to ever fucking do it. And I'd really, if I could sue them, I would. If I could stop them, I would. And it's not because I want the money. I don't. They're evil. Like, this lady is just fucking evil. Like, she doesn't care that you're hurting. She doesn't care. They thrive on that. And people out there watching it, they don't realise that we're actually people. And we're fighting for their entertainment.
And that fighting comes at a personal cost. You know, that builds up and affects you afterwards for a long time.
Like, this week has been another freaking week. I can't ever unknow those people that I met because of this whole process. We are stuck with the memories, we're stuck with the people, we're stuck with everything. and I don't know if I'm strong enough to help them. How can I, who am not that well, help somebody who's very unwell? How can I help them when I'm barely making it myself?
What's their aftercare system like? How has Married at First Sight helped you?
They give you this aftercare system where you can go use their site if you want to, but everything you say to her, she reports back to them. Or you can use Channel 9 service, and that's the same thing. But a lot of us were seeking counselling that was getting paid, and we did get up to the fifth session, and because we were going to get six sessions, they just cut us. It's really fucked up. Sorry, I swear a bit.
No, that's fine. Because I read an article and a representative of the show had said that that aftercare system never ends.
What about our families that then get fucked up? What about my son that hasn't recovered from the freaking wedding? What happens to them? What about Josh's mum that's, like, lost her business because of it? The aftercare, we don't get it. No one gets it. Who's going to go use it when it all goes back to maths anyway? It's just like going to their doctor. Like, you go to their doctor, everything I told the doctor got told straight back to the executive producers. Every single detail.
There's no confidentiality whatsoever.
Nothing. And that's a GP. How can that be? That's not legal. That GP should lose his license. They just do whatever they want to, and they have got it in their contract. And a few of us we've tried naming names, we've tried to get them to sue us. They won't do it. They won't do it because they're too powerful, I suppose. I don't know. Like, they see them treating us like shit. Can't one person filming, or one person, like there's 100 fucking people there in that studio, can't one person complain about the work conditions? That we couldn't get a drink of water in like how many hours? We're sitting there for like 14 to 17 hours. Give us a drink of fucking water. We don't want wine. We don't want alcohol. We just want some water. And why doesn't one person complain? Is their job that fucking important? Like, there is work place health and safety issues there, and no one complains. Does that not seem ridiculous, or am I just like going over the top?
No, I mean, I think someone withholding water once someone's asked for it is inhumane.
If we were prisoners in a prison and that was happening in prison, all of Australia would be up in arms about the prisoners. But because we were on reality TV, no one fucking cares, because we signed up for that. We signed up for no water. We signed up so that they would just neglect all of our human rights. That's what we signed up for.
But actually, you signed up to find the one. You signed up for the dream that was sold to you, not the actual reality of the experience.
And you think that one person with conscience, of those 100 people, one person would have conscience, because that would be a workplace health and safety issue in New South Wales. I looked up their workplace health and safety legislation. That is something, that they have to give you water, that they have to show us where the fire exits are, that they have to give us a seat to sit on instead of putting us in a tent.
You've been very generous with offering your time to prospective Married at First Sight contestants. You've offered, you can contact me so that we can talk about it. If anyone was thinking of going on Married at First Sight, what would the advice that you would give to them be?
Know why you're going on, and know that you are going on a reality TV show. You are not going on to meet the one. Speak to people that have been on the show, like speak to them face to face like this in these times, and don't involve your family. Don't have your family there, and actually don't do it. Don't do it. Don't entertain these people. Don't do it. It's not worth it. Your life will change. Everything will change in your life, and nothing is for the better. Like, I think that everyone that I've spoken to, we've lost everything. Our lives have changed, and not anything is for the better. Just don't do reality. Yeah, I don't know. Don't do it.
And that concludes my interview with Michelle Caron. I know that's not always an easy interview to listen to, but I think it's a really important one. Listening to her account, I can't help but feel that the producers willfully failed in their duty of care from the very outset. I really admire Michelle's bravery and commitment to speaking out and spreading the truth of her experience. And I'm really grateful that she chose to do that with us. And she chose to do it so honestly and openly. This podcast was produced by Hugo Chiarella for Unlikely Productions. The dulcet melody that you are listening to right now was crafted by Robert Tripolino. If you reckon this podcast is a bit of all right,
please tell your mates, post about the podcast and leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find the show. Come on, get a girl out there. You can also follow me at Gjoska on Instagram. Yeah, I know, that's Gjoska. Not my best, not my worst. You can also follow me, Scorthorn Gab, on Twitter. It's my name, but backwards. Hey, we should do this again sometime.